Noah's Ark, Roswell Incident. A short story prequel to the Noah's Ark trilogy by D. Robert Pease. Read for you by David Radke. Summary. In a future where Earth has been wiped clean of all life, and humanity has moved on to other worlds, 10-year-old Noah's Ark and his dad travel back to Earth, just after World War II, to locate and rescue a pair of soon-to-be-extinct northern spotted owls in the Pacific Northwest United States. Dad and I sat around the fire, staring at the flames. The s'more I was eating topped off what was probably the best day ever. We'd been surveying the forests around Mount Rainier for the past 3 days, and today we'd finally made our way up into the valley, where we'd most likely find the northern spotted owl. Here in the mid-20th century, the species would be extinct within the next several decades. I loved being outside in the fresh air, hiking the woods with Dad, who spent most of the day with a smile on his face, too. This was the life. Tomorrow, we'd catch a male and female owl, take them aboard the new ship called the Dove, short for Deployable Utility Vehicle, and head back to space. Tonight, I just took in the view. Stars looked so much different down here as they shimmered in the atmosphere. Of course, I loved flying the Dove, too. A glorious ship, all sleek, fast, and more importantly, capable of time jumping. Up until now, when we wanted to travel back in time, we had to do it with the Animal Rescue Cruiser, the Ark, a massive ship that took a great deal of time to prepare every time we moved her. We needed to take the animals to the Ark, but it was much more efficient to leave her parked on the far side of the moon and take a smaller ship back in time on our expeditions. I could hardly contain myself when Dad asked me to go with him on the Dove's maiden voyage. He'd even let me bring her down into the atmosphere, saying it wasn't every day a 10-year-old got to fly such a sophisticated piece of technology. He thought I was ready. I, of course, thought I was ready ages ago. Here, in 1947, the United States remained a bit jumpy after the end of World War II. They'd be ready to shoot down any unidentified aircraft flying in her airspace. I'd fidgeted quite a bit and chewed my lower lip a little, half expecting some kind of defensive attack, but Dad said I brought her in perfectly. It appeared no one saw us. Dad sat whittling a stick with his knife. "After we get the owls," I said, "can we go after the desert tortoise that Moses located? We used the robot Moses to find the best candidates for capture. Without him, we'd be spending all our time hiking around the planet. Not that I'd mind that."
"I'm not sure that's a good idea."
Dad stopped and stared up at the sky.
"We probably shouldn't push our luck on the first trip in the Dove. Besides, we haven't really scouted out the area where the tortoises live. I'm not sure what we might run into there."
It was always a good idea to study the history archives to determine if anything special happened during the times we visited. I'd read up on World War II in Earth history, but didn't know much about the United States just after the end of the war. "I could go get them while you go after the owls. Moses should have them located by now." Dad stared at me a moment, then shook his head.
"No, you won't have enough time to go down there and back before I need you. Besides..."
"But, Dad..."
"Enough, Noah. I agreed to let you come along. Don't push it."
I shook my head. It didn't make sense not to pick up the tortoises while we were already here. "Highly inefficient," my brother Hamilton would have said.
"Tomorrow, you can head back to the Dove and get her ready, while I finish the hike up into that valley."
"But, Dad, I was hoping I'd be able to hike up there." He looked at me and glanced at my mag chair. He wouldn't come right out and say it, but I knew what he was thinking. I couldn't do it since I was disabled, having been born without the use of both of my legs. He probably figured the chair, which hovered on a magnetic field, wouldn't make it through the underbrush. He finally said,
Then who would bring the ship up once we get the owls?
Okay, there's that. Maybe you... His look stopped me. Now I was just being stubborn. Fine. He stood and stretched.
We'll get up at first light.
He turned toward the tent, but stopped and looked back.
You know I don't think you can't go up there. There's nothing you can't do, Noah.
I nodded. I'll be in after I finish my s'more. The morning dawned gray and misty. I helped Dad pack up the tent and clean up the campsite.
Always return the area back to the way you found it,
he had taught me. He would hike up to where Moses had found the owl nests and, once he captured a pair, he'd give me a call and I'd bring in the dove to pick him up. We never just brought the ship in first, because animals tended to get spooked by the sound of the engines. Dad hoisted his backpack over his shoulders.
It shouldn't take me more than a few hours to get up there. Maybe a couple more to find the best pair of owls. Be ready for me.
Okay, let me know if you run into any trouble. I left him and headed back down the trail to where we'd hidden the ship. I entered the clearing where we'd parked her and breathed a sigh of relief. It always made me nervous to just leave the ship sitting there. No one would be able to get in that wasn't a member of our family due to the security systems, but still, that kind of technology in this time frame could really change things. Not that time can be changed, Hamilton would argue. Nonetheless, I hoped that we'd eventually get the shield modulators working that Dad and Hamilton had been building. Supposedly, they'd hide the ship completely from prying eyes. For now, we just had to make do with landing in remote places. I hovered up to the entrance in my mag chair and allowed the ship to scan me. The door whooshed open, and I headed inside. Once on board, I settled down for the wait. I hated waiting. I jerked awake at the sound of a voice on the comm.
Believe the pair fit all the parameters.
Dad?
Negative.
Oh, sorry. I was expecting a call from Dad. What did you find, Moses?
2 desert tortoise, easily accessible and available for extraction.
Yeah, well, Dad said we'll have to pick them up next time. Perhaps you could take a blood sample so we can pinpoint their location during another trip.
Acknowledged.
I hit the comm on my wrist and leaned back in my chair. A quick glance at the clock indicated Dad had only been gone about an hour.
I hate waiting.
Computer, where did we leave off in the Dove simulation routine?
Intra-atmospheric maneuverability.
At least I could put the time to good use. I moved over to the pilot's chair and pulled myself in. Computer, please load the simulation and route it to my neuroprocessor. I felt a tingling at the base of my skull, and my vision blurred as the ship screamed through the air. I never tired of flying these simulations. I was more used to flying another ship, called the Morning Star, but since construction began on the Dove-class ships, I'd been practicing on nothing else. I rocketed over the plains of the Midwest, where a patchwork of farmers' fields filled my view as far as the eye could see. It amazed me how much land area they devoted to growing food. Back home on Mars, in the 31st century, they grew everything in hydroponic farms in huge skyscrapers. Hundreds of stories filled with robots producing all the food everyone living on Mars needed to survive. Here, farmers suffered at the whim of the seasons and elements. A terribly inefficient way to grow food, but it sure was beautiful. Yanking the yoke right, I put the dove into a barrel roll. I loved the feel as the air grabbed her wings, much different than flying in space. Here, I felt in constant battle with the forces outside the ship. In space, just the slightest touch to the thrusters sent us shooting off in a different direction. I pulled out of the roll and headed toward the blue sky, practicing every situation I could think of. Flips, rolls, flying upside down, straight up, straight down, on and on. Despite the differences between flying in an atmosphere and flying in space, I had it down. Computer, how long has it been since I left Dad?
2 hours, 23 minutes.
Time crawled. No wonder people thought time changed depending on the circumstances. Hamilton had called it time dilation, which was what got Einstein thinking. His theories led to time travel and... this thought stopped me. Time travel! Computer, halt simulation! The virtual view outside the windows disappeared, and the forest surrounded me again. I hit the comm. Moses, can you send me the space-time coordinates of the tortoises? I glanced at the clock. 2 hours before dawn? Dad had said we didn't have time to get both the owls and tortoises, but we had a time machine. What difference was time? My stomach twisted in knots as I ran through the pre-flight sequence. Just nerves from flying such a new ship, and nothing to do with the fact I ignored a direct order from Dad. Computer, please activate mag thrusters, 20%. The Dove lurched as she lifted off, and I slowly rose between the trees. The mist that still clung to the forest floor gave way as the ship broke free from the huge pines. I caught my breath as the rising sun bathed Mount Rainier in an orange glow. We just didn't have views like that on the moon. I pulled back on the yoke and rocketed straight up. Nothing fancy. Go back, get the tortoises, and return in time to pick up Dad. He'd see the sense in doing it now. Computer, main thrusters, 40%. The sudden acceleration smashed me back in my seat. I almost didn't have my head back in time. The Dove, considerably more responsive than the Morning Star, rumbled around me as we rocketed toward space. I needed to get clear of the atmosphere before initiating the time jump. Computer, please monitor air traffic. It wouldn't do to be seen. A few minutes later, the blue sky dimmed. The view above me darkened, and hidden stars burst into sight. That's a view I'll never get sick of either. Computer, please stand by for time jump. I double-checked the coordinates Moses had given me. I'd be in a heap of trouble if I got something wrong and ended up out in the middle of empty space, or worse yet, jumped into the middle of a planet or the sun. Not that the computer would let me, but only an idiot would trust those things completely. Initiate jump now. The warp manifold hummed and roared to life. I glanced at the starboard monitor and watched as purple electrical charges pulsed along the wing. Seconds later, the warp field engulfed the ship, and stars blurred and warped around us. My stomach lurched as I felt stretched out, almost like being in two places at once. Then, it was over. I rocketed toward Earth instead of away. A quick glance at my monitor showed we jumped to the correct time. "Let's get down there," I said to no one in particular. Twisting the yoke, I lined up for re-entry. The best part. And laughed. Who am I kidding? They're all great. Orange flames licked at the ship's wings. The atmosphere ripped at the Dove as if doing everything in its power to tear her apart. The engineers back on Mars knew how to build ships to handle these kinds of forces, but it didn't stop me from imagining a fiery death. I gripped the arms of my chair as the ship bucked around me, and for several moments I couldn't see anything as fire engulfed her. Finally, I broke free. The sun rose to the east over the Atlantic, but darkness still covered North America below. Clusters of lights indicated cities, the largest along each coast. My eye went to the northwest, where Dad and I still slept in a little tent in the mountains. I laughed again. It was so strange to think of myself being in two places at once. My stomach lurched again. I sure hope this wasn't a bad idea, but I guess it's a little late to worry about that now. My gaze traveled to the Rocky Mountains, where I could just make out the lights of Denver. South, in Arizona and New Mexico, it remained pitch black, That's where I needed to go. I let the dove plummet a few minutes longer and pointed her toward the darkened landscape below. Let's get us some giant turtles. The dove screamed over the desert. In the light of a nearly full moon, scrubby bushes appeared, interspersed with cactus. I brought up a 20th century map and snapped it over the view of the landscape below. Only a few small towns dotted this otherwise empty part of New Mexico. One big block marked restricted didn't show anything on the map, and having no idea what that indicated, I avoided the area altogether. A flashing blue pulse marked the spot Moses had discovered the tortoises, about 20 miles south of a small town called Roswell. I dropped down and skimmed a few meters above the ground, which Dad had said was the best way to avoid the primitive radar the United States used at this time. A dim glow lit the horizon. That would be Roswell. Slowing the ship, I began to look for a good place to land, then laughed. Where couldn't I land in such a barren place? I circled around until the blue pulse on the screen indicated the tortoises were right below me. A narrow, double-track road snaked off to my right. Probably best to stay away from that. I settled down about 500 meters away, powered down the ship, unstrapped myself, and climbed into my mag chair. Having no idea how big the tortoises would be, I headed down to the hold, grabbed my backpack, and opened the main door. Dry desert air greeted me, and I breathed in the smells. What a beautiful night for a stroll. I pushed my chair down the ramp and out into the desert. Once clear of the ship, I spun and just stared at the stars around me. I seldom got to see such an unobstructed view of the sky. Even out in space, I had to look through a window. Here, nothing blocked the magnificent view. The great round moon sat just above the horizon. My home, although the craters I saw were unfamiliar. We lived on the far side, away from the prying eyes of anyone on Earth. I took another deep breath. I could stay here forever. Then again, maybe not. Even though I technically had all the time in the world, my stomach flipped and rumbled at the thought of what Dad would do when he discovered my little excursion. My wrist comm showed two blue dots just a few meters ahead. I pushed my chair forward, avoiding some prickly-looking plants and large boulders. At first, I didn't see anything, even though I was right on top of them according to the map. Then I realized that two of the rocks in front of me, nearly a meter across, were too perfect. I think I'm going to need some help lifting them. I pulled my pack around, unzipped it, and rummaged around inside. This would be a great opportunity to try out Sam and Hamilton's science fair project from last year. I pulled out a pair of gloves, which had silver wires running down each finger to a pad at the tips, and slid them on. Mag gloves, they'd called them. Hamilton had done most of the engineering, and Sam had built them in the shop. I pushed up next to one of the tortoises and lowered my chair to the ground. The creatures remained still as stone, probably sleeping in the cold desert night. I thrust my gloved hands forward and flexed my wrist, like Sam had shown me, to activate the fingers. Blue energy poured along the wires to the fingertips, and then shot out toward the tortoise. It took me a moment to get control of the energy beams, but after a few tries, I had the hang of it. Now, instead of short 5-centimeter fingers of a 10-year-old, I had fingers a meter long. I wiggled them in the air and laughed, and almost covered my mouth when my voice echoed in the quiet desert air. Fortunately, I stopped myself before slapping my face with my big honkin' energy fingers. I turned toward the closest tortoise, bent over, and brought the mag-gloved fingers of my right hand around the far side of the shell. It took a few tries to make the fingers flex like I wanted, but eventually I wrapped them around the tortoise, grabbed the near side with my left hand, and lifted. The mag gloves used magnetic pulses to help the wearer lift items far beyond the weight normally possible. But it still surprised me when the tortoise lifted off the desert floor. Big, round legs drooped down as I spun it around and held it out in front of me. Two eyes blinked open, and the tortoise's head shrunk back toward its shell. Bummer of a way to get woken up. With a glance at the second turtle, I said, "I'll be back for you in a minute." I swiveled my chair and headed toward the ship. The moon had set, and darkness now covered the desert. This, along with the tortoise in front of me, made it a little hard to see the path ahead. "Computer, can you give me some light in the hold?" Seconds later, the open bay door lit up with a blinding light. I held the tortoise in front of me to block the glare and moved forward. I was just about to the ramp when a noise snapped in the night air, as if someone had stepped on a stick. I spun around, still holding the turtle out.
"Hold it right there,"
a voice yelled from the direction of the second tortoise. I froze as a dozen men dressed in brown and tan uniforms moved forward into the light. Each held a rifle pointed toward me.
"Put your hands in the air."
I sat there for a moment, wondering what I should do. Cat would be furious if I got myself captured by the U.S. Army.
"Put your hands up."
I dropped the tortoise in front of me and thrust my hands in the air. The soldier's eyes went wide at the sight of the still-activated mag gloves. I smiled slightly, and could only imagine that, with the bright light shining behind me, I probably looked like some long-fingered alien. No time to think about that now. Just as the closest soldier started moving forward, I gave the command to my chair and rocketed backward and up the ramp. "Computer, close bay door!" The ramp started lifting under me as I thrust my mind into the Dove's computer system with my neuroprocessor. Skipping the pre-launch sequence, I gave the command to power up the mag thrusters, and the ship lurched beneath me as the door clanged shut. Through my neuroimplant, I checked the external monitors and found the soldiers all standing, looking up at the ship with their mouths hanging open. "Guess we can get the tortoises next time. Computer, incoming aircraft." The computer chimed. "What? How many?"
"3 Grumman F-8F Bearcats and 2 Grumman F-7F Tiger Cats."
I glanced around the hold and found some grommets to strap my chair to. No time to get back to the cockpit. Once my mag chair was locked in place, I dove back into the ship's computers with my neuroprocessor. The room around me disappeared, and I was seated in a virtual cockpit, the yoke in my hands. The sky above the desert filled my vision as the pre-dawn glow of the sun painted the western horizon pink. A quick check of the sensor array showed 5 blips heading toward me. 3 planes actually had me surrounded and approached from about 10 kilometers out. 2 planes, the Tiger Cats, flew from the direction of the restricted area I'd seen on the map. Must have been a military base. "Computer, are the planes armed?"
"Inconclusive. Sensors aren't equipped to detect 20th century armaments. However, my database indicates they are military aircraft."
I figured that one out myself. "Okay, let's do this." The Dove, like all of our ships, carried no weapons systems. We were scientists, after all. Still, it would be significantly faster than these planes, so it should be a simple matter of just,
"Aircraft are firing."
Puffs of smoke along the front of the wings of a plane off the port side indicated it fired its guns. The bullets might not penetrate the hull of the Dove, but not wanting to take that chance, I yanked the yoke left. I'd never practiced any combat simulations, but had played a few games with Hamilton. How hard can it be? A second plane flew dead ahead, and it too fired on me. "Time to get out of here." I yanked back on the stick, ready to head toward space. "Fire main thrusters."
"Collision imminent."
"What?" A Tiger Cat appeared just above me, and I peeled off left just as it fired 2 rockets. An explosion sounded and the Dove bucked beneath me. I glanced at the sensor array. The planes still surrounded me. Tiger cats flew above me, and three bear cats circled around. These guys are good.
Hull breach in aft sleeping compartment.
The idea that I might not be able to outfly these seasoned pilots entered my head, but I shook it off when an opening appeared between two of the bear cats. They had peeled off from each other to come around for another pass. I punched the thrusters and headed for open air, but moments before I could fly free, another aircraft lifted up in front of me. A helicopter!
Sikorsky, R-6 helicopter,
the computer said. Thanks for the heads up! It didn't look armed, but I didn't want to hit it. A tiger cat flew above me, and the two bear cats ahead were coming back, guns blazing. I could only go in one direction. Down. I pushed the yoke forward, and the dove plummeted toward the ground. Another explosion rocked the ship, and she started to spin. I pulled her straight, but had trouble keeping the nose pointed in the right direction. The ground screamed toward me. This isn't good! I fought with the controls, but the dove was sluggish. Landing thrusters! Moments before hitting the ground, the mag thrusters kicked in, jarring my whole body. They weren't enough to keep me in the air, but they definitely softened the impact. A grinding noise filled the hold as we hit the desert floor. The idea that I'd be caught by the U.S. military became all too real. I couldn't let them have the ship, but I couldn't let them catch me either. Computer, open bay door. The great door dropped open, and dust and debris filled the air as the dove continued to bounce along the ground. Nothing for it. I reached down and unhooked my chair when the door crashed to the ground, sending up a huge cloud of dust. I pushed my chair down the ramp as the ground slid by at an alarming rate. Raising my chair about a meter off the floor, I launched forward. The dove crashed on behind as I spun around from the force of the chair's magnetic field hitting the ground. Computer, main thrusters, 20%, and close the whole door! I ground to a halt as the dove fired her rear thrusters and barreled away from me across the desert. The five aircraft screamed overhead, chasing the dove as it continued on. About 2 kilometers away, the ship stopped with a sickening crash. It had hit a rise in the landscape. My stomach lurched into my throat as a huge cloud of smoke mushroomed into the air. Dad is going to kill me. By now, the sun had risen, and the desert grew hot. Several helicopters flew in and landed near the dove, and scores of men swarmed all over the ship. I glanced at my wrist comm. Probably a good idea to get out of here. Already, I could see men fanning out, checking the debris field for anything important. The map on my comm showed nothing to the south, so I turned and headed that direction. Most of the scrub in the area was taller than I was in my mag chair. Otherwise, they'd probably have spotted me, unless they assumed I was still inside. After about an hour, a faint cloud billowed up over the crash site. I grew hot and thirsty, and found a bit of shade by an outcropping of rock. A quick check of the time, and Dad would be calling any minute. I took a deep breath and hit my wrist comm. Dad, it's Noah. I ran into a bit of trouble.
Hello, my name is D. Robert Pease, and I'm the author of the Noah's Ark series of books for kids. When I set out to write the Noah's Ark series, I really had no idea where it would go. I just knew I wanted to write a fun story with lots of action and cool gadgets. But at the same time, a story with a little meat to it. Something that might make kids stop and think a little bit about life and their place in the universe. The idea of Noah's Ark came from a discussion I had with a friend of mine probably 15 years ago. We were actually brainstorming concepts for a video game or short movie idea. I think he was the one who threw out the name Noah's Ark. Immediately, all kinds of visual images started running around in my head. He and I worked together for a while on building a world. I even pitched the idea to focus on the family, but they said it was a little too cutting edge for them. Eventually, the idea died. It wasn't until years later I pulled it out again and realized it would make a great middle grade series of books. The final product is considerably different from what we originally envisioned, but nevertheless, it was a whole lot of fun to write. What could be better, after all, than a time-traveling ship full of animals in a post-apocalyptic future with robots and all kinds of cool technology? I wrote the first draft of Noah's Ark Mammoth Trouble one November for NaNoWriMo, which is National Novel Writing Month. If you ever had a desire to write a novel, check it out, it's really cool. My son was 11 at the time, and I fed him pages every night. As I heard him laughing and saw him devour each day's words in a matter of minutes, I fell in love with the idea that my stories could bring such enjoyment to a kid. I was hooked. The rest of the series continues to follow Noah and his family as they try to rescue thousands of animals and bring them to a future Earth that is finally ready for life again after some terrible cataclysm destroyed the Earth 1,000 years in the past. Of course, there are bad guys and great friendships. Everything you could want in a series of books. But in the end, Noah's Ark is mostly about the love of family and caring for those who can't care for themselves. I hope if you're a kid, or if you have kids in your life, or if you're 100 and just love action-packed adventures, that you'll give the rest of the series a go. And let me know what you think. I'd love to hear from you.
Hi, this is David Radke, narrator for Noah's Ark Roswell Incident, as well as the narrator for all three Noah's Ark books in the trilogy. As a voice actor, people often ask me, why do I like to do audiobooks? And it's a fair question. To a lot of people, narrating an audiobook is just sitting around with a microphone in front of your face and reading a book. Now, in some cases, that's pretty much true. You do sit down in front of a microphone and read. But recording an audiobook is so much more. It's not reading, it's performing. One of the things I love about narrating is taking what the author has written and adding that extra dimension to it, taking the words off the page and giving it life, breathing life into the characters, into the scenery, into the descriptions, into the characters' emotions and their dreams, their goals that they're trying to achieve throughout the book. I myself have been an avid audiobook listener for at least 10 years now. I've listened to well over 400 audiobooks that I have in my library, and I never get tired of them. Of course I love to read a regular book to feel the paper in my hands, but to me, there's another element of magic to an audiobook. When you get a really good narrator combined with a really good story, truly magical things can happen. And one of the most beautiful things about audiobooks is you can listen to them anywhere. You don't have to be sitting down in a chair in front of the fireplace with a cup of tea and some cookies. Audiobooks are for everywhere. I listen to audiobooks while I'm going out for a walk, while I'm on my way to my next job, if I'm at the grocery store shopping, and even at home cleaning up my place. I can listen to an audiobook anytime, anywhere I want, and that way I can enjoy many, many more books. It's the perfect portable entertainment. So if you've never listened to an audiobook before, why not give the Noah's Ark trilogy a chance? You can find the whole series at Amazon.com, Audible.com, and on iTunes. You can download it directly into your smartphone or your MP3 player and listen to it anywhere you want. And if you're already into audiobooks, well, then please, if you enjoyed this presentation, head on over to Audible, Amazon, or iTunes and pick up yourself a copy of the trilogy. Thank you, everyone, for listening, and I hope you'll hear my voice reading D. Robert Pease's fantastic trilogy in the near future. Thank you for listening.